So as I think most of you know, so far this year we've been exploring a pretty broad theme, the theme that we've called the way to freedom, what hinders and what helps. And we've been looking at some of the common obstacles that cause stress, distress and suffering in our lives, and what we can do to support experiencing more ease, happiness and peace instead. So that's been the overall theme, and we've been looking at that theme from different perspectives, different angles, different viewpoints for almost 3 months now. So tonight I thought it could be helpful to come back to the key word in that theme, which is the word freedom, also in the Buddhist context known as awakening, as enlightenment, as nibbana or nirvana. And I thought to revisit where we are now in relation to that central goal, that central aim. I was almost going to say central concept, but as I've been trying to convey, the freedom that's being pointed to here is not a concept. It's not an idea, an abstract idea. It's a lived reality that any of us can touch or taste, at least in moments. So I think some of you were here at our very first session back in January when I introduced this theme. Does anybody remember back that far? I invited you to do a written exercise, and we just took some time to explore what does freedom mean to you at that point. And this is a central question that I thought to revisit tonight to see where we are now in relation to that. But first, I'd like to just sketch out some of the range of what freedom can mean in the context, in this context, the context of the Buddha's teachings. So as I just briefly mentioned, the word I'm translating as freedom here is known as nibbana in Pali. Pali being the original teachings, the language that these teachings were transmitted in. So nibbana in Pali, nirvana in Sanskrit, variously translated into English as awakening, as enlightenment, as liberation. So I'm going to just dive in and give some snippets from the texts that might suggest some of the variety of ways that we can experience this freedom. And first, just to acknowledge, however we name it, as freedom, as enlightenment, as awakening, as liberation, many people struggle with, well, what does that mean? And even though nibbana is the ultimate goal of this practice, for many people it's a pretty hazy concept. It's pretty hard to grasp. And on one level that might be appropriate, because one translation of nibbana is that it's ungraspable. There's nothing to hold on to, nothing to cling to, including the concept of nibbana itself. So this non-graspability of nibbana can make it seem mysterious, esoteric, unreachable, vague, abstract. And it's true that in the Pali canon there are lots of words and phrases that seem to point to this experience. And they, in English, can sound a little negative if we're just listening to them with our intellects. So nibbana is sometimes described in terms of what it's not. It's the unborn, the unmade, the unformed, the uncreated, the unafflicted. Got it? On the other hand, it can also be described in more positive terms, the highest peace, the deathless, an island, a shelter, a harbor, a refuge. So you can get a sense there's a pretty wide range in those different words, from more concrete and poetic to fairly esoteric. And so For me, that gives us permission for any one of us to find what actually makes sense for us right now, here, in terms of what does freedom mean for you. As mindfulness has become more and more mainstream, though, I meet a lot of people, even sometimes on longer meditation retreats, And they might come for a practice meeting and they might say, just so you know, I have zero interest in nibbana. And I say, okay, what does nibbana mean to you? And usually they can't tell me. They just know nibbana's not for them. They don't know what it is, but it's not for them. And so I might say, okay, well, why are you doing this practice? Why are you on this retreat? And often they'll say things like, well, I'd like to live with a bit more ease or happiness or contentment. Or I'd like to understand myself better and stop hurting the people around me. Or I'd like to make a positive contribution to my community. Or I'd like to be a better role model for my children. And in some ways, all of these are actually aspects of nibbana, expressions of nibbana. Particularly in one very practical definition of nibbana that's given in the Anguttara Nikaya, one that I particularly like because it highlights the ethical aspects of freedom. So I'd like to read you the actual words from the sutta. You know, they're slightly old-fashioned, especially if you haven't heard this kind of language before. But I think they give a fuller sense than if I just were to paraphrase it. So at the beginning of this quote, you'll hear a reference to lust, anger, and delusion. And as many of you know, these are the three core afflictive energies that the Buddha saw as being responsible for keeping us circling around and around in unskillful, painful, harmful states. So just for reference, lust, anger, and delusion are also sometimes translated as greed, hatred, and ignorance, or compulsion, aversion, and delusion. So here are the actual words of the text. It says, enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, and overwhelmed with the mind ensnared, people aim at their own ruin, at the ruin of others, and at the ruin of both, and they experience mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one aims neither at one's own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and they experience no mental pain and grief. Thus is nibbana visible in this life, immediate, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. So one aspect of that quote that I appreciate is that it points to the benefits of this practice, not just for ourselves, but for others too. As it says, when the mind is freed from greed, hatred, and delusion, we're protecting ourselves and others from ruin. So there's an ethical and altruistic dimension to this freedom. And if we understand nibbana as the heart mind that's free from greed, hatred, and delusion, it becomes possible for every one of us here to have some understanding and some direct experience. Because every one of us has tasted times when our hearts and minds are not totally entangled in those afflictive states. Now, I'm not saying that those moments are complete nibbana, but they can give us a tiny foretaste of what is possible. And the more we learn to recognize how it feels when those harmful states are reduced, even if just in moments, the easier it is to access those states again. And with time and with practice, they start to become more and more the default setting of our hearts and minds. As one Tibetan teacher famously said, enlightenment is an accident. Meditation makes you accident-prone. So that's another way that we can think of this whole path of practice. We're trying to make ourselves more accident-prone in a good way. And we do that by understanding more and more clearly what mental qualities support the kind of clear seeing that leads to this freedom, and what mental qualities get in the way. So just as we were doing earlier, that kind of clear seeing feeds into our everyday lives. So we can recognize more and more quickly when we're getting distracted, when we're getting entangled, when we're getting identified with our experience. And we're able to see how to help that reactivity to release. So it's so important to be able to recognize when we are closer to the state of freedom, because our default negativity bias tends to move straight to the next problem, the next issue, the next challenge, the next thing I've got to deal with. Anybody notice that? You know, there's that slogan, mind the gap. You might mind the gap between the crises and the problems and the challenges, and see what it's like to rest there and to really let that in as the beginning of a taste of freedom. So what I'd like to do now is to take some time for you to explore that for yourselves, to explore those moments of relative release, of relative peace, of relative freedom, in the context of your own lives, to practice recognizing, to practice acknowledging what's it like when the heart mind are not so caught up in all of those entanglements. So those kind of moments, they might happen during a meditation retreat or maybe in one of our evening sessions here. Maybe you can think of a time when you were absorbed in a pleasant activity, maybe walking along the beach, or really fully listening to your partner, or being listened to. Or maybe watching a sunset. Or maybe as one six-year-old who was introduced to mindfulness in school, and somebody said to him, "What does mindfulness mean to you?" And he said, "It means I don't punch someone in the mouth." And so we can think of that as a moment of freedom from greed, hatred, delusion. Every time we get triggered and choose not to react, that too can be a moment of freedom. So this is optional, but the invitation is to form, like we did a few weeks ago, into a group of three, and then you can take it in turns just to hear from each other your own, just reflecting, contemplating on how are you experiencing freedom in your everyday life? Now, if this doesn't feel like something you want to do, you're welcome to either just sit quietly on the back bench there, or if you feel like this is enough for tonight, you're welcome to go home. But if you'd like to stay, I invite you just to find a couple of people to work with, preferably people you don't know so well, and then just set up around the room and I'll guide you through the structure of it. Okay, thank you.